From the heart of the Forest City, focusing on the biggest stories in London, this is the Craig Needles Podcast. Now here's your host, Craig Needles.
It's the Craig Needles Podcast, and it's time for the Friday Roundtable at Classic Rock 98.1.com, London News Today. .ca. We are powered by our good friends over at the Covent Garden Market and at downtown London. We are joined here in the studio today by London City Councillor Steve Lehman. Disability advocate Jeff Preston is here, as is former Green Party candidate Carol Dick. Hello, everybody. Thank you for being with us today.
Hello.
Hey, hey.
Hey, Craig.
Okay, let's get to the stories of the week. And I do want to discuss, it's sort of back in the news, but we're not quite all the way there yet, is the hub conversation. And maybe at the old Bell radio studios where... I guess the stations are, well, the country station, the Virgin station used to be, and CJBK used to be, could be a spot for a homeless hub in the not too distant future. This building, I think, makes all the sense in the world, but there are some neighbors pushing back based on the location. Not for the standard reason that we've heard, those reasons are crazy, but these reasons are more along the lines of, hey, there's already two hubs in this neighborhood. Steve, where is this at City Hall right now? Has this been sent to you? I know you're the chair of planning. Has that conversation happened there yet, or is it still in the very early stages?
This is in the very early stages. I just became aware of this application earlier this week, talking with Councillor Pelozzo. That's her ward. My understanding is there's going to be coming probably before PAC planning, an application for rezoning, which would include use of this space by a hub operator. But that's the extent that I know of this particular.
So they haven't told you from the perspective, like who would be operating the hub or anything like that?
No information at all on that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I'd like to see that before I definitively state what my opinion on this is going to be. I would be open to it, even though the location does seem a little bit funny. Carol, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so, I mean, as we were talking about, it is a good location building-wise, but I definitely think there needs to be more effort to spread out the hubs throughout the city. I mean, for many different reasons, but I think we've seen in some other areas where you stack all the services in a particular area, it can create more problems, whereas if we spread it out, it becomes more integrated within the community, and I think there's a lot of benefits for that. So it's something that we need to be working way more towards and not just having everything down in the south.
And I think that's a reasonable criticism. This is not, oh, won't somebody please think of the children. This is the city's plan was let's have these things in various neighborhoods as opposed to all being within a few hundred meters of each other, Jeff. So there's at least like a reasonable criticism here, I think.
Yeah, I think this is a different situation than perhaps what we've seen previously, where there have been other pushback from community members. I think it's difficult when you start to cluster services together. There are some benefits in terms of access, whether it's having a bus line, for instance.
Right, and this is we're going to be right on a transit line
to where it should be. There's that consideration. I think there's also the consideration of how what was I think a really good intention when we instituted a bylaw to prevent say group homes, for instance, from being clustered together, with the hope that we don't create, just put all the disabled people in one part of the town and put all of the people who are experiencing homelessness in another part of the town. I think that the idea behind that is a good idea, that we should not just be siloing people. At the same time, I think we also need to be careful that as we do start to spread services out, we start to reduce the number of places that we can then place services, because everyone starts to bump up against the variances and the bylaw that prevents them from being placed in certain areas. So I think this is going to be a really interesting conversation at City Hall to try to balance this need to provide access while also not overloading into one specific part of the city.
Yeah, and like Carol said, and she and I were talking about this off the air before we came in here, the building is a really good one, and it's on a transit line, and there'd be a lot of space in there. So I think from a council perspective, and again, Steve, you haven't seen everything here yet, but I think that they're at least be open to the idea based on a few things, even though the location may not be exactly what we want.
Well, I think Jeff raised an excellent point. In an ideal world, we would like equidistance between all 13 hubs. But we've already seen challenges in finding what locations meet as much as possible the criteria.
We may not be able to be choosy here.
Well, how choosy do we get?
Yeah.
And how close are the hubs to that specific location? and Carol mentioned, you know, it's on a transit line.
Yeah.
The building, as you mentioned, Craig, it seems like a pretty secure, good building. Yep.
I've been in there a couple of times.
Right.
And so there used to be a radio station in there. So there's going to need some work to be done inside.
Sure.
But yeah, the building makes sense.
Yeah. So I understand the dangers of clustering things. There's no question about it. And we've seen the city go down that road and have to backtrack on that. So I think, as with most things, there's never a perfect thing. So it's going to be pluses and minuses. There's a lot of pluses I see here. There's some concerns for sure, and you know, look forward to seeing those, plus also seeing who's going to be operating it. You know, Craig, you mentioned that, and that for me, that's probably the crucial thing, because it's supportive
operating it. Yeah, who are we going to be supporting there? Is this going to be potentially? And again, I have no information that would lead me to believe this, but a CMHA coming back with, hey, you know, the hub that we got shot down on the north end. Well, we might be able to pull it off here. And if that's what we're talking about, okay, that's interesting stuff. If Adelosa is coming back and saying, hey, we've got another idea for hub, that's interesting stuff too. You know what I mean? So I want to know more details before I really get into it.
And it's not a homeless shelter.
Yeah,
this is different. This is very supportive housing. So when I hear homeless shelter, people think of different things, right? So this is a pseudo medical facility, which is included with my understanding for the rezoning, which has a specific wording
with paid personnel. And if it's anything like the previous plans, security staff to make sure everyone there is safe and in a good spot. And that's fair to say that this is different than calling it a shelter. It's a hub, and for good reason, it'll be classified differently. Jeff, we need more hubs, obviously.
Yeah.
So we might just be in a spot where we got to take them where we can get them.
That's the reality, right, that we're dealing with. Because going out, sprawling out the city is not a solution. Certainly not a solution with the infrastructure that currently exists. And with, I think, the ability to extend infrastructure even further outside of the city, London is only as big as it is. You know, unless Arva is ready to get swallowed, you know, there's only so much room we have. And that's me putting Arva on notice.
Yeah, Arva. So I look at this and I think there's something to it. Again, I want to know more, but I wouldn't be a hard no right away. I wouldn't necessarily be a hard yes, but I wouldn't be a hard no right away is what I would say. We'll see where where this all progresses to and what happens next. A couple other stories I wanted to talk about this week. For starters, let's talk about what's going on with London Transit. They continually are getting these bus shelters smashed. It is annoying. It is a pain. I don't know what, if anything, they can do. If there's anyone who the LTC listens to, it's Dr. Jeff Preston. Jeff, what should they do? Or maybe the answer is, there's not a lot they can do.
You know, Craig, I got to say, if the LTC is experiencing problems with vandalism, they just have to tell us. That's all they need to do. If they just tell us, you know, that would be really helpful. So
they should write you a letter to tell you what's going on.
If they let us know. Yeah. Now, I will say maybe we will have difference of interpretation of what the problem might be.
Listen to like 3 podcasts ago if you want to know what Jeff's talking about. It's a deep cut.
I'm so sorry. But you know, I want to say, you know, I have one more joke.
Okay.
maybe an interpretation of this, something. I'm just asking questions. I would be interested to know if there's any type of causal relationship between vandalism of bus shelters and satisfaction with service. In cities where there's higher satisfaction with service, do you see similar satisfaction? Or do you see similar vandalization? Now, okay, I'm going to take my tongue out of my cheek now and say quite firmly that this is a super complicated problem. It's an extremely frustrating problem. And I think when I look at it, the thing that I think a lot about is that right in London, and really in London for the last maybe decade or so, the thing that I hear a lot from people in London when they're talking about it is that London sucks, right? People have a lot of complaints about London. It's not a fun town. It's not up and coming like other places. It's boring. It doesn't have a direction. And I wonder how much of that is sort of at play here. Do we really appreciate the city that we live in? Do people really see themselves as citizens in this community? Do they see themselves as having a responsibility to building and making this city better? And How we change that perception in London, I don't actually have a really good answer. But I wonder how much that is actually a connection here. Is people not seeing London as a place that they feel particularly passionate about and feel as though it's their responsibility to do something to make sure the city is safe and nice? And that's really sad, but it's something that I think we actually do need to tackle.
I think we've got to tackle it as well. And I know people have said, well, let's do plexiglass. That comes with cleaning challenges, with maintenance challenges. Carol, what do you think, if anything, the LTC can do about this? And the answer might just be they have to just keep replacing the glass shelters and that's it.
Yeah, well, so Jeff's definitely hit on something there that I was thinking about. So there are a few things. One is, have we looked at some of the other cities that are comparable? Are they going through in our general area? Are they going through the same problems with this vandalism? Is it attached to some kind of lack of pride for the city? Because on top of just these bus shelters that are getting smashed, there's been a lot of comments, and it has been in the news as well, about the amount of trash that is everywhere, like extreme amounts of trash and a lot of littering. And it's tied to this same sort of idea of where if you don't really appreciate your city and you don't take pride in it, you might be involved in also vandalizing. I mean, we think about the number of shops that have also had their windows smashed in, whether to steal something or not to steal something, just in general. So I think there are the bigger issues that need to be addressed to hopefully stop it, and it might be something to do with the city itself. In terms of actually addressing the vandalism itself, I know that it might not work here necessarily, and there might have been some negatives with it, but I know that in BC there's a lot of wooden bus shelters, so but I feel like the issue with that is that you can't see through them.
Yes. And that's so relevant. You have to see when your bus is coming.
Yeah.
And I know some people have talked about, what about fences, essentially, kind of like a ball diamond dugout. And the wind's going to get through that. It's not going to help in the rain. It's expensive, Steve, but I don't know what else to do. Like, if plexiglass is no good, and I've asked it around, like, hey, is plexiglass kind of an option here? A, it's more expensive than putting the glass up. B, it's definitely more expensive to maintain because it warps and you have to clean it more and so they just may be in a bad spot here.
Yeah, well, Carol mentioned she spoke about shops getting their windows broken.
Yeah.
So having a shop downtown, I know what that's like.
Yeah.
We probably have our windows broken probably about 3 times a year.
Yeah.
And I think in the past it used to be mostly from rowdy students getting out of bar time and up to shenanigans. But lately, I think we've seen an increase from the mental health issues that we see on the street and addiction issues as well. So what's the solution? It's hard. We don't, I think stores could always put the gate down that you see in other cities where they put a metal gate down at night. I hope we never get to that point. So I've been thinking about this, and I find a correlation, because sometimes you see spurts, like you see where all of a sudden the bus shelters getting smashed, and it's either copycat or something else. Very similar to tagging, and we had a graffiti problem in this city for a while, and a lot of tagging, and when the police looked into it, it actually came down to like about 3 or 4 individuals. So I don't think we can just put our heads in the sand and say, it's a cost of doing business. I think we have to look at it and see if there are certain individuals that are going around and doing it, or it might not be. Like, it might be...
It might be the same person over and over again.
Yeah, as Jeff said, it's endemic of the society we live in, other issues that we were seeing on the streets today.
Here's what I say about this, and I think I've said this in the podcast before, not about smashing bus shelters, just about people doing things that are jerk things to do. And it's a jerk move to smash a bus shelter. You're not getting anything out of it other than your own cheap entertainment. It's dangerous. There's all sorts of reasons to not. It's dangerous for not just humans. It's dangerous for people taking their dogs for a walk. There's glass on the sidewalk. There's all sorts of reasons it's dangerous. I think that we as a society are in a place where we were told for a long time, hey, if you go to school and get a job and do the right things, you're going to be okay. You're going to be, have a chance to live a decent life that you're fulfilled with and you're happy with. And that's becoming less and less the case in the last 10 to 15 years because of affordability of housing, because of affordability of just everything generally, the way that jobs kind of have been shipped out of the country in some cases, and the jobs that remained have been lower paying jobs. I think that people were told, hey, if you play by the rules, things are going to go okay for you. And then things are not going okay for them. And then they're finding ways to act out. I'm not saying that's what's happened here. All I'm saying is that I think accounts for a lot of when people say, well, society has a moral decay now. I think what I just said accounts for a lot of it is, hey, if you do this, you're going to be fine. And then you're not fine. And people felt they'd been sold a bill of goods there. Jeff, I don't know if you think I'm wrong there. But.
Yeah, I mean, there's this great little book that it came in actually before COVID, but weirdly foreshadowing, called The Great Unwinding by George Packer. And in this text, the thesis of the book is that a lot of the core pillars of our society have started to become unraveled over the last two or three decades. Less people are associated with major religions. Less people are associated with service clubs. Less people are volunteering. Less people are getting involved in community organizations. And what's happening is that more and more of us are becoming isolated in our world, whether it's isolated because we work long, hard hours and we don't have the time, energy, or money to do anything else but work and sleep, or that we're on the hustle trying to find jobs. We don't have time for community. All of that got worse during COVID, like a lot worse for all of us. And that while a lot of us feel like COVID is in the rearview mirror and things are quote unquote back to normal, they aren't. COVID is obviously still here. And we're still trying to deal with this literal trauma that we all experienced, which was many years of fear, anxiety, and isolation. And that's going to take a long time for us to rebuild. And it's something that we must actually take active measures to rebuild. Like, it's not something that will just happen. It is something that we actually have to work toward. And who needs to do that work? Well, ultimately, all of us. All of us have a responsibility in rebuilding the community that we've lost over the last decade.
How do our phones come into play here? And you hear educators talking about banning phones from the classroom. Are we teaching our kids to be isolated, to be live in their homes, only communicating through their phone and social media, as opposed to getting out and engaging outside the walls? So I couldn't agree more with you, Jeff, on the comments about our society becoming more isolated. I see it. I see there's less neighborhood associations. I see in the service groups I belong to, hard to get people to volunteer.
Yeah.
For sure, that as we become more of a secular society, church attendance is going down. And what was church attendance? It was community,
absolutely.
Right? Plus the religion, but there's also a huge community aspect to that.
And I actually saw an interesting tweet about that, and we're getting like way outside of what to talk about. But I saw an interesting tweet where someone said, you know, the one thing that, like, if you want, say what you want about different religions and whether you like them, whether you don't like them, the one thing that secularism has not been able to replace that religion was able to bring to the table is that sense of community. And I saw a very interesting conversation about that on Twitter this week. And I think that there's something to that. And I don't know what the solution is, because I think for a lot of reasons, and in some cases for good reasons, people have said, okay, I've had enough of religion X or religion Y because of various things that leadership has done wrong. But that sense of community that used to be sort of at a pillar of society is no longer there. Anyway, bus shelters. I think that the London Transit folks, if they come back and say, hey, you know what, we looked at all the different plans and the best one is to just, it's annoying, but keep replacing these and hopefully people stop smashing them, I would understand that.
Yeah.
I don't think I would reject that plan. I think that would make sense if that's what they wind up doing.
Absolutely. Yeah. We need the shelters.
Yeah. You can't not have bus shelters.
Not shelters is sort of the only option here that I think
that option to me should be off the table.
The only one.
Yeah. Is because, like, you know, people need a place to sit or stand if they're waiting for a bus, if it's windy, if it's rainy, so it's not miserable. And further than that, and I saw someone mention this on social media too. If you're waiting for a bus and you've got two little kids, it's very easy to say, okay, we're all going to sit here in this bus shelter on this busy street and wait for the bus. If you're standing at the busy street and you've got the two little kids, I walk my kids to school every day down a busy street. And, you're kind of always really watching to make sure they're not even, like, they're never on the road, but even too close to the road, because you don't trust everybody. It's just the bus shelter is different. So they got to have something that protects for wind and rain, that you can see through, and that gives you sort of a space for people waiting for the bus. Glass might just be the only option. That's it. Let's talk about the London Public Library. And they have announced this week that they are making some changes to their hours for Sundays. And I understand it. They say that, hey, we're a little bit strapped for budgetary reasons here. I know there's been some pushback on that. Steve, what do you think of where the library has come out and what they've been saying about their hours and their Sunday situation here?
Well, first of all, I'd like to say that for all our boards and commissions, I understand what they're going through. It's mm-hmm. extremely challenging with inflation causing their costs to go up. From a city's point of view, it's a tough budget. And mm-hmm. I'm not exactly too happy to hear this. And I'll tell you why. Because the chief librarian came to council and asked for some help in getting through 2024. And at the time, council granted an extra $332,000 to get him through 2024. And he said, that's all we need and we'll get through. So budgets aside, now to say now we're going to have to cut hours. And I just want to put this in perspective. Firstly, those three library branches, Cherry Hill, Masonville, and Boswick, mm. they're the only three outside of the Central Library that have ever been open on Sundays. Right. And they close for the summertime on Sundays anyway.
Yeah. Right? So really it's September when we're going to see
the changes. It's a bit and yeah. a bit early in spring. So I know the mayor said, I understand the challenges the library is going through. And he said, I'd love to meet with, board members and executive to kind of discuss the near-term challenges. Mm-hmm. I think he's going to be frustrated, quite frankly, because they haven't reached out to him on this. And then right. all of a sudden you wake up and you read it in the news that they're cutting hours in the headline. Right?
And as you mentioned, they said around budget time, okay, we're okay for this year for hours.
They did.
We don't have to cut hours.
Here's the money we need.
Yeah.
And we gave it to them.
Right. And now in March, they made the decision, but in April it gets announced, we might be having some trouble with hours here. So that has changed, and I can understand the frustration there. Carol, because I want to go to you first on this. There was a lot of criticism, of course, over budget and what library was getting, what transit was getting, and so on and so forth. Where do you stand on the idea of losing Sunday service at these particular branches? This is clearly not what anyone set out to do, but it's the reality that we are living in now. What are your thoughts?
So I actually think this ties into what we were just talking about with community and sense mm-hmm. of belonging. And I did post about this on Twitter today, got a bit of pushback on it. But let's just take the Cherry Hill location, for instance. And that is a location that is right close to a lot of senior citizens. And this is an area where they can meet. I know that when you go into the libraries, you can often see people reading newspapers together or doing a puzzle or doing mm-hmm. different things. It is a part of the community. And for me, I really feel like the libraries are the heart of one of the pivotal parts of a city. They're important for kids, newcomers, families with young kids, the programming, everything. And so for me, it's an area that needed the funding to keep it going. Now, I understand some places saying, well, that, you know, there's not as much foot traffic on the Sundays and, you know, they don't operate it all the time anyways. It would be nice if, in fact, they became even more of a hub and a location where people knew that they could go. I know that the library close to us, it isn't open on Sundays, but it would be fantastic if it were, because there are a lot of underprivileged kids in that area. And if you go on any weekday, that library is absolutely jam-packed with kids and seniors. So for me, I was very vocal about the fact that I felt like the library needed the funding to be able to keep libraries open, keep the hours open, and offer the services that are really important to the citizens of London.
And I get the frustration from the council side of this, though, because there was the belief that we've funded this so we don't have to cut hours in 2024. And then we do. So I would like to know what's changed, and I'm going to be asking people with the library mm-hmm. about that. But I do very much want to know what changed in essentially the time from the budget being closed to March 21st, because it's the March 21st meeting where they made this call. Mm-hmm. Jeff, losing libraries on Sunday sucks. And I think, to me, libraries are a tentpole thing a municipality should be doing. I think everybody agrees on that. It's one of the most important things municipality does in the way that we've got this set up in the province of Ontario. What do you think might be the outcome here if we are talking about legit closures on Sundays?
Yeah, I mean, I think picking up from where Carol left off, I think that libraries are a part of this bigger, broader problem we were just speaking about. which is, you know, part of the discourse coming out of COVID, has been the degradation of, quote, third places, right? So we have the place that we live, we have the place that we work, and we're losing access to places that are not driven essentially by capitalism. Mm-hmm. So if you want to go and hang out with friends, yeah, you can go to the food court at the mall. But what are you doing at the food court at the mall? Well, you better buy something if you want to be there. Or you want to go to a night's game, hang out with some friends, watch the game. Great, but you're going to need a ticket, and well, you can't have bags anymore, so better bring some beer money with you too, or water money, perhaps. I think that, libraries are such an important community gathering place, in part because the library is not trying to sell you anything but knowledge. And maybe that's actually the most important product that people can access right now that they shouldn't have to pay for. And at the moment, we're down looking at things like our phones, going back to the counselor's comments, as the source for knowledge. And I got to tell you, the books that you're going to find at the library are far more valuable than the tweet you're going to read online by some dude who probably doesn't know what he's talking about.
Hey, I like take me. That personally. Yeah. Like,
for instance, don't listen to us. No. Go read a better book at the library. And, you know, in an ideal world with some more funding, maybe we could not just read on Sundays, but every day of the week.
Yeah. And I want to know what's changed. And I will say this. If a sitting city councilor is not sure what's changed and the mayor is not sure what's changed, the library needs to make some alterations as far as how they've communicated this then. Right? And again, if you want to argue that, well, the library didn't get enough cash, I think that there's an argument to be made for that. Absolutely, there's an argument to be made for that. But there shouldn't be a lot of debate that what they said they were given enough cash to do is not going to get done here. So therefore, something must have been altered in between point A and point B here. I'd like to know what it is. That's all. And again, I'm going to be asking around about that. I, to be clear, have not asked about that. And I don't know if Steve, if you had a chance to ask about that. And again, you said that they have not heard from the mayor. The mayor has not heard from them this. So I would like to know, that's all. And I'm open to explanation. But even if you want to say, well, the council didn't fund the library well enough. They thought they did fund the library well enough to accomplish this exact thing. That was what they were told they did. So we'll see what happens with this going forward. I want to talk about one thing before we go. And Jeff, this is in your wheelhouse just because of the education sector. even though I don't think you teach at medical school.
Not yet.
Yeah, not yet. Not yet. Yeah. Doug Ford has said that he thinks that medical school spots in the province of Ontario should 100% be taken up by Ontario students. I think that is fraught with peril. I don't know if that's how we should be doing things. I don't know if I want to be looking at someone's address when they apply to medical school to determine whether they get in. I would just like to see the best, you know what I mean? Like, I would just want to see who should be in, get in. Jeff, what do you think of the premier's comments there? I think he was just talking and said something silly and didn't mean it, but yeah. What do you think?
Yeah, I like, to me, this is divisive politics 101 in a lot of ways. It's what we're seeing in the South coming up north saying, we got to protect ours or someone else is going to take it. The reality is med school, international students at med school, is a very small percentage of the people. We're not talking about entire med schools being operated solely by international students. And if Doug Ford wants to know why there are a rise in numbers of international students in med schools or in universities and colleges more generally, perhaps he needs to ask what happened in 2019, what his government did in 2019 that has led to this outcome. And, you know, if he could answer that, then, you know, maybe we could have a conversation about international students after that. But frankly, to me, as you said, I think that it should be the best candidates that are getting in because we need doctors. Mm-hmm. And it appears that, you know, there's pretty good evidence to suggest that when people come and do med school in a country, not just Canada, any country, they tend to stay there. And they tend to practice medicine and help that community. So to me, if you want to come and be a doctor here in Canada and help Canadians, welcome here. Yeah. Welcome home.
And I understand the conversation surrounding international students. And we've talked about this on this podcast before. It's you have Fanshawe as an example, bringing in really, really large numbers of international students. We don't have enough place for those people to live. And that turns into a massive crunch for the housing market in the city of London. We've talked about this. I think everyone is close to on the same page there that, hey, this may have gone a little bit too far. And I think that makes sense if we're talking about Fanshawe in certain contexts, Conestoga and Kitchener, whatever it is, and Steve, you and I both have experience in that community. But when we're talking about medical school, I don't know. Like, you know, when he's saying 100% Ontario students, that means that someone from Vancouver who wants to apply to come to be a doctor at Western, we're telling them no too. Or someone from Montreal or someone from Halifax. I don't know if that's the road we want to go down. That feels like we're asking for trouble, Carol.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's ludicrous. I don't think it was just like a one-off comment because he made some other supporting comments. It was like he was doubling down on his comments.
Yeah, he talked about like, how sad it is when kids from Ontario go to school outside the province and they meet someone and live there. I'm like, so they fell in love and started a relationship with someone and built a family in some place. Like, that doesn't sound tragic to me, but anyway, that's neither here nor there.
So if you're... I mean, there's a number of things. Number one, how about you do a better job of actually supporting your universities, because your policies have made it that a lot of universities became dependent on the fees that are coming from international students. How about also you do a better job of funding the elementary and high schools so that you've got students with excellent test scores, but not just that, the knowledge to be able to go to medical school, to be able to compete with other international students. So there's that. Also, we need doctors. So again, just like what Jeff said, if people come to Canada, they likely will stay there and practice medicine here. And we need the doctors. I actually know several doctors that live here in Canada that are not Canadian citizens, and they're fantastic doctors. So this is just it is just kind of divisive politics. He's just throwing it out there. But yeah, what are you going to do? You're not going to allow other fantastic students from across the country to come study medicine here. And guess what? They might fall in love and stay in Ontario. Yeah. We get an extra doctor.
There's that too. I don't think that anyone is going to put together a policy piece at Queen's Park where something like this gets voted on. I think that would be crazy, but I don't know. Steve, do you think that the premier maybe just was talking and then words came out? He's done that before.
Well, you know, you mentioned, I think international student enrollment at colleges and universities has been in the press.
Absolutely.
Related to housing. I mean, that's been a very hot topic. Interprovincial. Restrictions. Look at McGill and Concordia.
Yeah, right, that's true. Quebec, they got a lot of heat.
So here
that.
We go. Are we going to be so insular that we're just going to stay within the province, which I think is a very dangerous thing? Jeff spoke to that. But I'm going to play a bit of devil's advocate here.
Okay.
Because look at the tuition difference. A local kid pays $30,000 a year, I think, roughly, for a year at med school. 100 grand for an international student.
Yep.
So if I'm a kid from Ontario and my average is like 96.7 and they look at another kid who's 98.9 or like really close. I mean, if you're 96 point whatever.
You're one of the smartest kids.
Yep. You're brilliant, right? Is there a temptation for the university?
We'll take the kid who's going to give us 100 grand.
Give me 70 grand more a year.
Yeah.
I'm not saying they do that, but I'm saying, boy, it's mighty tempting to, as Carol said, they've got to meet budgets as well, and their revenue streams are limited to what they're getting from tuition and government. So,
why the provincial government needs to do a better job of funding the university so that they don't have that temptation of just picking the students, maybe with lesser grades, just so they can get that $100,000.
I will note this. I think that there's a world where the provincial government says, and this is a magical world that is not going to happen, they say, okay, we're going to give a 25% funding bump to the following universities and colleges, and those universities and colleges are still gonna want the kid paying 100 grand over the 30 grand because they wanna build that extra building, they wanna do that extra fun thing, and they're still gonna be tempted by the money. You know what I mean? So I think there do have to be rules as far as the number of international students per institution. I just don't know if only med students from Ontario is where we start with that is what I would say. There has to be some sort of guardrails, and you don't have to look much further than when you see the rental listings in and around Fanshawe College to realize that, okay, we've driven off wherever the guardrails are supposed to be here. And there, that has left an impact in the community. And again, I'm not blaming the kids that come over here. In fact, the kids that come over here from, India, from China, wherever it is they're coming from. They're sold a bill of goods on as far as how great and fun and cool things are going to be in Canada for them. And they get here and their only housing option is to live in a house just off campus that was built as a 3-bedroom family home. And now there's 12 people living there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So like we're kind of sending them up the river too. Like, so it's hurting the communities when they arrive, and when they're here, it's hurting it as well, because we have not built the proper infrastructure for housing at Fanshawe or various other colleges. And Conestoga is the other major example that jumps to mind, where you're bringing in all these international students and you have no place for them to go. That's what's frustrating.
Yeah. Absolutely.
All right, we'll have to leave it there because we are up against it for time. So thank you very much to Steve and to Jeff and to Carol for doing the show with us today. As always, the Craig Needles podcast is powered by our friends at the Covent Garden Market and downtown London. Next week's Friday Roundtable, we recorded live at the Covent Garden Market. We've finally figured out our supply chain issues. And by we figured out, I mean the company has apologized to us for the mistake they made. I'm not going to say the name of the company, but they have said they are sorry. So we are going to be live from there on Friday. So I hope everyone can listen to that podcast once it comes out. Very excited about that. And I hope everyone has a fantastic weekend. Whenever it is you are listening to this, the Craig Needles podcast can be found at londonnewstoday.ca and classicrock981.com.
The Craig Needles podcast is a presentation of the Blackburn Media Podcast Network.